When we got 1 million subscribers, I had no idea. Like, nothing we would have done would have been like whatever. And then it also kind of seems self-serving when
it does.
Put this grandiose production together for your millionth subscriber. Oh, it's so great. And here's my 1 million subscriber video. Thank you all. Now watch this video. So we literally just mentioned it in you mentioned it in a video, I'm sure.
The 1 million, I guess. Yeah. I really don't know. Isn't it weird? I have very little memory of that. it's very strange. I don't know.
Remember when you got your 100K?
Sort of. I don't really remember that. I remember the 1,000, strangely enough.
Yes.
Was like a kind of a big.
Because that was such a substantial number.
Yeah, it did seem like that. Because I just saw a video the other day about like YouTubers who quit YouTube or something like that, or sold their channels, I guess it was. And it showed Fred, you know, he was the first to get 1 million subscribers, but that wasn't until like 2010, 2009. So even him, the biggest channel on YouTube, it took him that long to get to 1 million subscribers.
And I argue 10,000 subscribers seemed like such a surreal amount of people that by the time 100,000 rolled around, it was like, wow, that is a really... But we had kind of talked ourselves into it at that point. I think that's what was really impressive about 1,000, because I kept thinking about like arena sizes. I'm like, wow, we'd be able to fill an arena of 1,000 people with our videos right now. And then when it got to 10,000, it was like, oh my gosh, that's a proper sized stadium. But then when it gets to 1 million, like it's hard to
It's hard to imagine that. I was just thinking about that last night. I was at a large theater, saw a concert. We went and saw Elvis Costello. I don't know if you remember
Elvis Costello. Wow, that's awesome. Yeah. So, watching the Detectives.
Yes. I got to get into this. Let me take you back. So we thought we'll go to there. We'll get there a little bit early so we can go out and get some dinner. So, you know, this is in they call it the theater district of San Francisco, which is right next. It's basically the Tenderloin. And the Tenderloin, if you don't know the Tenderloin, it's basically San Francisco's equivalent of LA's Skid Row. It's like really, really depressed area. It's been like that for over 100 years. You know, it's just like one of every neighborhood or every city has that area. So I like, well, I don't have any problems just parking there. I use the Spot Hero and reserve a space in this parking lot a couple blocks up in the Tenderloin. So we get there a little bit, a couple hours early, and we park there, and we're like, you know, you're always like looking around. You never know what's going to happen. But anyways, we made it fine there. But I wanted to go to this place, which is considered the best Vietnamese restaurant in San Francisco. It's been there for forever. And I've known about this place for 30 years, and I've just never gone there, even though I've always said I wanted to do it. And I thought, well, this is a great opportunity because it's right near the Golden Gate Theater, which is where we were going. And so this is on 6th and Market, which is like also like kind of the roughest part of the city right there. And there's this little dump of a Vietnamese restaurant that is just so crowded with people, but it's known for their food. In fact, they have on their menu like an article when Julia Child visited the Toulon to have their Vietnamese food. And it's just this hole in the wall place. So we went up there, and they kind of recently, like, I don't know, they said they did some improvements to it. I didn't see that many improvements. It's still this weird place where you walk in through and go up these back stairways, this little upstairs room to eat. And there's like this weird decorations on the wall, like the Eiffel Tower and stuff. I mean, I guess there's a French Vietnamese connection there, but you know, it's just really bizarre experience. But the food, oh my God, is just so good. And they give you these massive, massive portions. So we enjoyed our meal, and we got out, and I thought, well, let's take a moment to just walk down Market Street. The show doesn't start for a while. And so we started walking up Market Street, and all of a sudden, there are cops on motorcycles, the siren just blazing, you know, just so loud, going, and it's echoing, it's reverberating through Market Street. It's like a canyon in there, you know, flying down. There's two of them. I'm like, oh, wow, there's some shit going down someplace. And the next thing I know, there's like two more coming. And then it's like just cop after cop. It's been like 20, and they were blocking the streets off. And I'm like, what is going on? And I thought, oh, wait a second. This is like some sort of politician or something is coming, because this is what they do. I've been, Obama used to visit San Francisco all the time, and they would always do these road closures. And so we stopped because we couldn't cross the street at that point, because this two cops on motorcycles that got out and they blocked the side street, so nobody could walk across the street, nobody could cross. And there was one guy, there was this this guy in like his 20s, and he was like on a scooter, you know, and he was like dodging across the street, and this cop is standing there, and the cop is like super fat cop. And as a side note, shouldn't cops have some sort of like fitness requirements?
No. Yeah.
How does this happen?
I get that.
But he's not there, and so he's yelling at this guy, "Get off the fucking road! What are you doing out here? You God!" And he's just, the cop is just screaming at this kid, and so the kid's like, "Oh, okay, I don't know what's going on." Nobody knew what was going on. Next thing you know, there's this huge motorcade coming through, and it's like just cops after. There must have been like 25 motorcycle cops in preceding this. And it's huge, you know, limo armed cars, and there's the ambulance following it. There's all these support vehicles. So I'm Googling this, and it's Jill Biden. Jill Biden was in town. And so she just passed. I had no idea. And I thought it was maybe Joe Biden or something. But I the first article I found was Jill Biden makes an unexpected, pops up unexpectedly in San Francisco or something. I thought, wow, that's really weird. I had like this odd brush with fame, even though it wasn't a brush at all. I just was waiting while, and so I did shoot a video of it, which was because I didn't know what was going on at first. But yeah, I was looking in the window. I couldn't see anything. But man, talk about some pomp and circumstance when those motorcades go by, because they've got like, it's like basically a city. They've got, that's why they have the ambulance. Yeah. They have everything prepared, I guess, in case Jill Biden faints at the sight of San Francisco homeless tents and stuff. Women don't do that anymore. In old movies, they used to always,
or clutch your pearls.
They could just collapse at a moment's notice. So we
people like Jill Biden have ambulances to tend to those needs as soon as
crazy. And car, you know, and Market Street's closed to cars anyway, so she got special privileges. It's only open to buses and cabs and that sort of thing. So,
and the first lady apparently.
That's... But I guess Joe's going to be here also this month or something. But hey, so we got through that. We went to the show. The show was fun. You know, it's definitely the geriatric crowd. But here's the funny thing. The opening band, they call the support band now is what they call those.
Oh.
Yeah, I guess.
They're not openers anymore?
The supporting act is what they're called now. But the supporting act was Nick Lowe. Do you know Nick Lowe? Does that name... The only song of his I knew was...
Cruel to Be Kind.
That's the one.
There you
go. Gotta be cruel to be kind. So that's the song I knew, and I think everybody knew. So here's the thing. He performed, you know, this old guy coming out on the stage with his backup band called Los Straight Jackets. And they wear masks like Mexican wrestlers or
luchadors.
There's the word I'm looking for. And so that was kind of cool to see them. I'm like, wow, there's like his backup band is like Slipknot or something almost, you know? And then here's this guy singing. So he's performing these songs, and I didn't know. It's like rockabilly kind of music. It wasn't bad. It was, you know, I didn't know any of the songs. And the crowd is like politely clapping after each song. And then he's like, okay, well, I'm going to take a break for a couple of minutes and let the Los Straight Jackets play a couple of numbers. And holy shit, he walked off the stage, they performed two numbers and killed it. The audience was like, all of a sudden, everybody perked up because they were playing like this, like surf music. And it was so, I have never seen that happen before where the background performers are, you know, upstaged the main guy. You know, the background singers basically had their own show, and they killed it. I mean, it brought the house down. It was crazy. And then he comes back on stage, hey, it's me again. I kind of felt awkward for the guy, but he did play Cruel to Be Kind finally, And then Elvis Costello came out. And, you know, it's one of these things where if you see a band where you know some of the songs, but not a lot, it's a different experience than if you're like a real fan of the music. Because if you're a real fan, you know all of the songs. But, you know, Elvis Costello has been around for 50 years probably, you know, performing music. And I only know him really from the 80s, watching The Detectives, you know, Angel Wore My Red Shoes and Pump It Up and these songs of his. And he did play some of those, but then he also got into this like experimental jazz fusion kind of like, hey, we're going to bring it down for a bit. And the songs would go on for like a 10-minute song or something with them. Everybody's just kind of noodling on their instruments on stage. I was like, oh, the woman next to us, granted the average age of this crowd was like 80 or something, you know, but she was like falling asleep. And so, but then he comes in, he would play a few of his hits, you know, Allison. He played like Allison, which is one of his big songs, but he did a version with just him singing and a guy playing a piano, and that was it. No other. So he would take his regular songs and then change them. I guess if you're like a huge Elvis Costello fan, this might be right up your alley. But, and I you know, I guess it kind of begs the question of, do you, when you go to see a concert, do you want to see all of their new songs? And these probably even weren't new songs. They're probably ones that he's been playing for the past 20 years, but I don't know him for the past 20 years. Or do you just like, you know, it's like the old cliche of like, Freebird, Freebird, you know, just play the one song we know. I don't know.
I can only imagine when you've been doing it like what, since the like the early 70s,
yeah,
you've been doing it for that long that you a respect that, dude, you got to play Allison, you got to play Washington, that you're like, you got to play the stuff that, you know, you what whatever. But Elvis Costello, I think, is in the cool enough tier. He's in that like the David Byrne
tier.
Well, he's not in the David Byrne tier, but like he's like up there as far as like, I'll go with you. Like, I'll go with you on your adventure over here. And so the drummer from the Rolling Stones had a jazz band. And it was like, if you liked it, you would like, yeah, I'll go over here. And so I think Elvis Costello can kind of get away with it. While you were talking about Nick Lowe, I pulled his Wikipedia up. He's the producer of the first 5 albums of Elvis Costello.
Oh, okay.
So he's got it in. He was probably
a little nepotism.
A cheap opening / supporting act.
Yeah, probably.
And I'd be curious to, did you investigate the band Los?
Los Straight Jackets. No, I did not. And so that was, it was interesting. It was sort of like a real, it was really good. It was kind of surf music, I guess you would call it. It was, had that real twangy, you know, Pulp Fiction kind of music. But
I think you want to move on, and I think you want to play the 3 hits. To answer your earlier question, I think you want to play the 3 to 4 hits that people like. You want to certainly make it worth people's money so they can sing along and identify. Yeah. But you don't need to go into deep cuts. We definitely don't want to hear anything from the new album. Mm-hmm. That is just like death for bands like Toto
or
Journey. Like when you see a band, it's like, yeah, I'm coming for your hits. And if you're going to play other stuff, I actually even more respect Elvis Costello being like, here's something kind of completely different, or here's like whatever, or like, I don't know, whatever. It's at least something different versus just like, here's a concert I would have played in 1982.
Yes.
Literally the same songs beginning to end, and I haven't grown. That's like, all you want is like the songs that you like.
Exactly. And that's what I was, I was telling myself, and I think this is a good attitude, is like, well, look at this as an opportunity to hear music that you wouldn't hear. I mean, we've all heard the old songs. So why do I need to hear those again? Because he's just going to perform them differently anyways, which is also kind of a good thing. I don't need to hear it like the recorded version of the song. But I think that he's also kind of a virtuoso musician, and he's been married to Diana Krall. I don't know if you know her, jazz kind of singer, and they've been married since 2002, something like that.
I'm pretty sure she's Canadian too.
Oh, is she?
Yeah, no, I died.
And he's lost almost all of his accent. It was really weird. He hardly sounded British anymore, but
Do you remember him in Austin Powers' Man of Mystery movie?
Was he in that?
Elvis Costello. Uh-huh. Yeah, I was playing. It was literally as Elvis Costello. And my kid, a couple of years ago during the lockdowns and whatnot, when we were endlessly searching on Netflix for content, we came across this awesome cartoon called Pete the Cat, who's also a kid's book and da-da-da. And it is created and voiced by the one and only Elvis Costello.
Oh, really?
And, yeah, it's very cool. So it's very musically kind of inclined, yeah. And he plays the father, which is very cool. And yeah, it's just, he's one of those guys. Mark Mothersbaugh from Devo.
Yeah, Mark
Mothersbaugh. Produces movie soundtracks. Trent Reznor's getting into that now, where it's just like, you can see that there's so much more to someone than just Johnny Cash before he passed.
Tom York.
Doing cover songs. Tom York's another good mm-hmm. example. Jack White. People who are just willing to like, hey, here's, you know, if I'm going to go see a Jack White concert, I want to hear all your hits. But like, yeah. what else can you bring? And then Jack White will pull out a guitar and it'll sound like he's playing on a tin can with some wires attached to it.
Yeah, yeah. Well, you know, there's the form of metal, black metal, which, yeah. And that is, the whole aesthetic of it is try to get it as lo-fi as possible. They want no fancy engineering. And it, basically, the crappier it sounds, the more pure and honest, I guess it is.
Is that pushing the boundaries though? Is that like when you're at the, because the, what's the very aggressive sounding where it's just like,
well, that's death metal, and black metal does a little bit of that too.
So does something exist simply because it is just the like opposite of, or is there legit some deeper meaning that a larger percentage of people, including myself, like just don't get with why someone would want to just listen to someone scream?
Well, so I tried, because I was very curious about this a while back, about the metal growls, because there in the 80s, there was heavy metal, and that is kind of its own thing now. When people refer to heavy metal, they're usually talking about Iron Maiden and all of these old bands from Judas Priest, I guess,
what
might have been one of those.
Motorhead.
And then it, to a certain extent, would go up into like thrash with Metallica and blanking on some of the other names, but Anthrax would have been one of those. But now when you talk about metal, it's kind of like all forms of metal, and heavy metal is that certain period of the 80s, kind of the more melodic sound. So I was curious, why did metal change and why is there this growling now, and screaming, I guess, like a heavy metal scream. And so I fell into this, you know, rabbit hole of looking into metal. And there's an amazing, like, 6-part series this guy did on YouTube about, like, the history. Is he some Scottish guy did it, like, the history of metal and all of the different subgenres of metal, of all types of music. Metal has like the most sub-genre. There's like pirate metal, and there's like all this weird different. There is, and people just love this stuff. But the metal growl, one, you have to read the lyrics to understand what they're saying, which they want you to do, because they want you to read that. It makes their music, you feel like an insider. If you know it, you know it. And if you don't, then you, so there's this kind of attitude.
Like it's like a club.
It's like a club. And metal is very tight that way, a tight-knit bunch of
community.
People.
Yeah.
And that the growl is really more of an additional instrument to the band rather than vocals is. So it kind of is like an extra guitar in a way. That along with the blast beats, and there's all these other types. But anyways, I learned a lot from that, and I think it kind of opened my eyes to a lot of the different types of subgenres of metal, and I find it really interesting, and a lot of it I do like. I think if I had to pick one of those subgenres, it would be death metal, just because I like the attitude and I like the themes, and I love the energy to it. Black metal though, I mean, they intentionally go out and get like the worst quality bikes they can find, and the,
right.
the all of this right. stuff is
lo-fi.
Yeah.
And I dig lo-fi too, but like when it's intentionally lo-fi, yeah. I'm glad I'm at the point in my musical tastes where I cannot in any way want to listen to something, but still try
have an appreciation for it.
try my darndest to find out what is appealing about it to people, whether I agree with it or not.
Right.
While you were on the topic of, no, you know what? That would just be, should we actually bring up the fact that it's 100 episodes?
We can mention that.
Do you think we should mention the fact Chad, that this is the 100th
Chad,
episode?
Do you know what this episode is?
Let me see. The last one that we did was number 99.
We're going to put an importance on 100. Here we are. Woo-hoo.
There's a ridiculous pressure associated with that. Yeah. And I felt kind of almost odd even knowing that we agreed to, like, we were just going to sit down and record an episode and obviously mention that, it's the 100th episode. But, like, it's weird because
Even just this transitioning into it is like, how do we? I don't know.
How do you talk about, like, because it's just so, I don't know. This place has become a very comfortable place just to come and talk about whatever comes to our mind next. And this kind of seemed like the first thing that has had to be talked about.
It's sort of the 100th
in a particular episode.
The 100th elephant in the room, I guess. But it is one of those things where I always feel like everybody knows how to do these milestone things, and I don't.
Yeah. And I was like, should we go through and like do a greatest hits? I'm like, oh, we'd have to listen to so much stuff.
Exactly. And I mean, I've had this on my channel before where there's some sort of milestone and I always think I should do something special to commemorate. And then it comes around. I'm like, I don't know. It's just another episode. I can tell you that I'm very proud of the way that this podcast has evolved since our first episode, which was in 2020. And we just kind of hit, we were doing Zoom and it was really lo-fi again. We had the crappy audio and it's kind of funny to listen to that now and think, oh my God, that was bad. And we were doing the same thing when we started this as we have kind of come full circle and are doing now, is just you and I talking about stuff. But it was interesting how we started out just talking between you and me about YouTube, because that was kind of our connection. And we originally had, that wasn't even when we started the podcast, because we started before that, because we thought we were going to do a different podcast. Remember, like 6 months, maybe even a year earlier, we had even done a couple of false starts where we were like, thinking about, well, let's hire an editor to edit the audio. Let's get this legit. What are our things we're going to talk about? We thought maybe we would be like just a YouTube advice channel.
YouTube talk.
I remember we recorded those and it was very difficult because it sounded like we were trying to be other podcasts.
Right. Or like the space needed an agenda. And
right.
That was it. And even when you change it to something else, it's like, okay, now the space should be this. It just, that builds after a while. And I think that's why we, for the first, 10 episodes or so, it was just you and I, like, figuring out how to talk to one another. And then we had a guest on.
Yeah.
Our very, very first guest was
Tim Schmoyer.
Yeah. And I remember being all nervous and whatnot. And then
even though we've talked to him plenty of times before, we knew him very well.
About the subject of the podcast, which was YouTube. So like stuff that we could easily talk about. And it was fantastic. And I remember after that being like, yeah, we should get more people on. And obviously we agreed to that because we got a whole bunch of more of our friends and people and da da da. But like each time that we transitioned to something new, we defined the space before we went into it. It's funny that you said that, like, before we had even recorded our first podcast, we were talking about like what platforms are we going to distribute it on. It's like, maybe we should think about making the content first. But you almost become cocky because you're like, well, I know how it works on YouTube and da da da, but like that's not how it works in the in this space.
Our YouTube experience is useless at this podcast.
And the way that people watch YouTube videos, none of that like translates over into this space. And you realize that it's a completely different group of people who love podcasts. And that's, I think, why podcasts have done so well. And while we were talking and sharing our ideas about what we should do for the 100th podcast, I sent you that Reddit post and I thought it was kind of interesting. And there was 4 points in it that I just wanted to share because I thought they were interesting. We had a few years ago investigated what makes a popular podcast or something like that. And for some reason, in and around that time, I remember the number being like, you needed thousands of downloads, 5,000. And some people were getting tens of thousands of downloads on their podcast. And then anybody in the dozens or the hundreds or the, you know, even low thousands felt like, oh my gosh, what does it take to...
Yeah, what's the point to continue?
What's the point? Now, here's the truth. 90% of podcasts don't make it past episode 3.
That's amazing.
So that's about 1.8 million podcasts, which no longer are quote unquote active. They only did 3. So there's about 200,000 podcasts left. 90% of those quit after 20 episodes. So that's another 180,000. To be in the top 1% of podcasts in the world, you only need to publish 21 episodes of your podcast. Your competition is not 2 million podcasts. It's about 20,000 podcasts that didn't quit. So that's kind of like verbatim read off of that. But it really hit home because I know that we've always, you know, maybe kind of compared our numbers to numbers on YouTube or larger numbers, which
that's
we just
all we
think or whatever. Because, yeah, because I don't think you appreciate the space, or I don't think you respect how you do earn that. So to the point that I think they were trying to drive home, it's about not quitting. And the thing I am most proud of is that we have made it to 100 episodes without quitting, even though we quit twice before.
Right, to get to this point. So it's our third shot at it. And I think that the important thing to know there is that if there's about, what, 20,000 active podcasts, is that what you were saying? Something about that?
According to this.
Actively. And that seems like about I would guess that that's pretty accurate. Just kind of judging by the podcast landscape.
Yeah.
But I think the reason why is because people who are doing podcasts, most people are doing it just because they love doing it. So there's a passion to it, other than those, you know, those real top Joe Rogan and these guys who make a living at podcasts, which is very rare. Those are like the supermodels of, you know, we're just modeling stuff for the Sears catalog. Yeah. But the Sears doesn't exist anymore. I don't know why I use that that example. More we're like the bread and butter. But I think people who are doing podcasts are doing it that way because there's no money in it, really. Not like YouTube. And this is why those numbers are so different. If you look at active YouTube channels, people who are actively making content, it's in the millions. And it's because there's a monetization incentive there that YouTube has in place, where there's nothing like that for podcasting, other than, you know, hey, start a Patreon, which is also very difficult to get people to sign up for a Patreon, which we tried it and we're like, yeah, like two people. Yeah. It's not worth the trouble.
You just, and it just looks so
so needy.
Three people support this show. It's like, it's not quite that bad. It's better than that, I assure you. But
it was fun though, those first times when we had the guests on, because what we just went through our Rolodex of people that we were already friends with and had those all on. And then once we'd kind of burned through them, then we're like, I guess we should
brought them all on again. And then we're like, wow, we should
we should find some new people. And so I think it was you who found who asked Michael Buckley, and I think he was kind of our first person that we didn't know personally. We'd both probably met him before, but I'm sure he didn't remember us. I remember meeting him at Clamor.
Yes. And I DM'd him, and he was, oh man, within 15 minutes, he was just absolutely sure. And he did remember from the ClamorCon days. So, it set the tone because the interviews were easy because we were not easy, but they were easier because we were talking to friends, people that we knew, and we had a kind of like a cadence with and whatnot. And then there was the intimidation of interviewing Michael Buckley, where it's like, oh my gosh, now we need to kind of prepare interviews and like really. And then after that I marked that as a huge success, and we had Craig Weezy Waiter on just after that, and then a few other kind of like new faces and YouTubers who were established and people I had watched in the past and now wanting to be on the podcast. So it was like, this became really, really interesting. And then we I think where you were going is like, we ran into the, like, okay, well, we don't want to just keep bringing people back on. We don't want to turn this just into an interview show. So then we kind of transitioned to like, oh, hey, let's just kind of go back to me and you for a little bit. And within that, over the past probably 40 or 50 podcasts, we've worked a balance of like bringing a guest on occasionally, but more so leaning into this just being this open space that we don't need to define beforehand.
Right.
And that, like, and yeah.
Yeah, I like that we kind of stopped overthinking what we're doing and we just sort of went with what felt natural. And, you know, we never had a point where we're like, okay, now we are going to stop inviting guests on the show. Or we were just kind of like, hey, you know what would be fun is to talk to somebody else who we really clicked with. Let's have them back on the show from time to time. So I kind of like that there's kind of a revolving, you know, bunch of people who are willing to come back on the show just because they just like to talk the way we do. But I enjoy just the two of us talking too, which is a lot more freeing. And it's a lot, it does remove a lot of the stress involved with the, especially when we were doing weekly guests and having to prepare for all of that. It's a lot of work. I remember the Michael Buckley, when you mentioned him, I was like, oh my God, he's huge. I remember watching him back in the day on YouTube. And so I like over-prepared. And then we were lucky we had him because he was the perfect guest. He just talked. We couldn't hardly get a word in edgewise, which was, it's like the best type of guest is one that you just don't have to really interview. It's just a conversation.
They're right there with you. So at the bottom of this particular post, if you've done podcasting for some time, do yourself a favor, go back to listen to your very first episode and use that recording and ask yourself a few questions. Steve, are you more comfortable in front of a microphone than you were then?
Yes.
Are you a better interviewer?
Oh yeah, absolutely.
1000%. Are you a better writer or outliner?
No, I don't think we do much of that.
Are you more engaging and entertaining?
Oh yeah, I think so. I think
because you're more comfortable. Yeah, just
I think those two kind of go together. Yeah.
Is this the most real Steve Ramsey that anybody could probably listen to this? And whenever you are doing a podcast,
the podcast that I do with you is definitely the most me. And that's just you and me, not with the guest.
And here's the kicker: number 5, is our podcast better today than it was when we started?
Easily.
Yeah. Yay. Well, happy 100 episodes.
Yeah, we did it. We made it to 100. So I think that we can now close up the shop. We don't need to do any more.
That's it. Well, that was, I was going to say that. How many of those, I mean, that's a good point. A lot of the podcasts didn't make it past 20 episodes. Is that also kind of the point? Because if you look at Tim Schmoyer, for example, he's had a whole bunch of different podcasts. So he's still actively podcasting with whatever the title is that he has now. But there are archived podcasts, which are also a thing. I guess people would put together a 10-part series in a podcast format, and that would have a beginning and an end. Do we have an end to this, or we're just going to keep going past 100?
You know, I think we don't have, I don't have any plans to quit. I mean, I just enjoy doing it, like I said. I think that there is a phenomenon, what is it called, pod creep or pod decay or something like that, where podcasts eventually they start slowing down and then you just never hear from them again. And I would rather that didn't happen. But as it is right now, this is like one of the hours of the week I look most forward to, is just talking.
And through the week, I find there's things that I write down or remember or take note of simply for this.
Yeah, me too.
This open space. And I think that's how
that's why we talk about AI so much recently. I'm like, God damn it, here's a new AI thing I want to talk about.
That's very true. And that leaked over into a couple episodes. And we're like, oh my gosh, we're talking about the same thing in a couple of episodes. But
I think if there's anything that we probably talk about as far as what kind of content we're going to produce for the show is if we'll talk sometimes about we're leaning too heavy on one thing. And like recently it's been AI. We've been kind of, do you think we're talking too much about this, or even YouTube itself, even though that's sort of the conceit of the show, is that it's sort of, I guess YouTube could be considered the hub of this show, since that's kind of our common thing. And so much of what we talk about is YouTube. But there's been times when I think, wow, I wonder if we're just talking too much YouTube.
And then some of it classifies as like we just share videos. And like that ends up becoming a YouTube conversation because you send me Internet of Jay's video where he's, you know, speaking of wrapping up shop, there you go. So, and then something like that, so we'll just end up parlaying into a YouTube.
Yeah, what do you think about that? Because we've talked about Internet of Jay before and how he was one of these COVID channels who rose real fast doing YouTube commentary on like YouTube drama or other YouTubers, like the rise and fall of so-and-so or whatever. And I didn't realize that that's just a hobby for him. And so in his last video, he's like, well, I'm quitting, I'm done. And so he made the rise and fall of Internet of Jay, which himself was really funny. Yeah, and that was it.
And he had a really innovative approach to thumbnails and all of the rest. Did a really, really good job and shows his progression from the COVID channel and just started. I think he's smart enough. Well, he's clearly smart enough because I believe he's a banking professional in New York City or something like that. Like he clearly is in a place where it was for, and he says that in this video, I was doing this because it was a lot of fun to do, but I'm always enamored by people who can understand when to put a lid on something and move on from something. And it's doubly interesting with him because it's not only because he has a completely separate career that he can go back to, so he doesn't need to worry about, he doesn't need to be thirsty for the money on YouTube, right. But he also sees the trajectory of your average commentary slash whatever video essay, those guys run their course as well. So even if he wanted to push into a different space, he was going to have to change because after a while doing the same content over
he even mentioned over that in the video. I know that space is already kind of becoming dead.
And how quickly does that happen now? Because I was listening to one of our podcasts with Tiffany, and that didn't really seem like all that long ago. That was maybe the end of last year. And we were talking about shorts starting to decline. And at that time, we were talking about, oh, there's a lot of interesting channels right now making like video essays and stuff like that. And we were literally positioning it as like, this is some new interesting content coming out of YouTube. But like within 6 months, we're completely exhausted by it. And we have thousands of channels doing the exact same thing.
And they're just regurgitating Wikipedia articles, and it's amazing.
And then they reference the other now there's responses to those videos, and that just it's a battle of attention and just using people's name to generate clicks and views and all of the rest. And that is not a long-term plan, especially a professional banker would definitely know that.
Yeah, hey, he was pretty smart to do that. What about you? Do you have any ideas where you'd like to see the podcast go? Or is that something you even really put much thought into?
Now that it's in this place, I like it exactly where it is. So I almost don't want it to change for any reason. I almost like the fact that we're just mildly unsponsorable that it doesn't add that element of needing to say anything. As awkwardly as we bridged into mentioning 100 episodes, of course we would do a great job, and if you're willing to just give us money, we'll give you money, we'll read your ad, but like I accept that would be a different place for the podcast. I don't think they would necessarily need to interfere, but that would take part of it and change what it is right now. Because right now it is 100% a selfish outlet. And it's interesting because we brought up the Internet of Jay thing. It's like I'm in a position where I don't need to make money out of this. And that actually makes that incredibly appealing right now for me.
Do you think the podcast that we do would be different if there were comments on it the way YouTube has?
I think so. I think that's the thing. It was so. Remember how many podcasts episodes we had? We're like, email us, send us a message.
Not a single email.
Mail a letter to us. Send a carrier pigeon. Do anything to just acknowledge. And we had some people fill out the Apple reviews or whatever it was and rate us 5 stars. But very few people did. Thank you to all the people that did do that. But you appreciate that this isn't also that space for those people. Like you respect the listeners. And after a while you realize that you're not like, you're not talking to the same people that are watching you on YouTube, because they're watching YouTube for a different reason. And people who listen to podcasts for a completely different reason. So I want this to be as pure as possible. And pure,
I don't feel like I need to, you know, beg for comments and approval. And I do kind of like the fact that it's just, it exists on its own in a way that YouTube, because YouTube, no matter how much you think we're just going to keep driving the way we want to drive, you're going to read those comments and you're going to start to adjust your content.
1 billion.
Because of those. Mm-hmm.
And that's the part. That's why people like YouTube, because they can go and interact with their creator, like with the people that they watch on the screen. And that's fantastic. So it's almost expected, and it's like a symbiotic relationship, because then the person gets to hear what the audience wants, and that encourages more of the audience. But that's what makes this place special, because the many people who do listen to this listen to it every week.
Yeah.
And it might be 1 week about AI, and it might be 1 week us struggling to figure out what to do for 100 episodes. But that is almost like the fabric of the content in itself. And that might sound a little strange, but like that ends up becoming a self-fulfilling prophecy where it's like, you're here for the authenticity. The authenticity can only be there if this space remains exactly what it is right now. And I can see how, if we were to get a sponsor, it, like whatever, it'll just become something different. But to answer the original question, would I change anything right now? No.
Yeah. I'm
completely, completely happy with where we are.
Yeah, me too. I just like the space, being able to just kind of talk about whatever we damn well feel like. It's very cathartic. Please. It's sort of selfish in a way. And if we did, you know, if we had a, you know, larger, say, you know, huge Patreon following or something, we would definitely have to start stepping up our game in that way that people expect.
Because then you're going to start hearing the things that people like. Mm-hmm. And every single person with an ego is going to hear the things that that person said that they liked about them. And they are going to make a mental note the next time that they're delivering. They're going to think of that person or put that kind of image in their mind, and they're going to change a delivery or whatnot. And it's very, very subtle, and it's exactly what you're expecting on YouTube. And there's nothing here. This is just a big empty room.
Yeah.
Hey, you know, I suddenly feel lonely.
You know that video I posted about the deck? Remember last time I told you?
Yes.
It was it started at like number 9 or 8 or something. It was just languishing. Then all of a sudden it shot up to 2, and then number 1. It was number 1, and now it flatlined, and now it's sitting at number 5.
So you have hit the view wall as well.
It hit the view wall. It came all at once. It was really weird. It was like, this thing is really, all of a sudden, it started out slow. Subscribers weren't watching. All of a sudden, it got hit outside of YouTube. Bam, everybody's watching it. And then you can look at that graph, and it's like just so flat. And it's like sitting at number 5 or 6 right now of the past 10 videos. So I don't understand it. I thought, my first thought was, oh God, maybe I should change the title and thumbnail. Maybe now I should try the more clickbait stuff, you know, because I thought I had great results with just using the anti-clickbait approach. But, and maybe now if I did change it to a more clickbaity thing, it would jump up a little bit. But I'm also kind of just over that video. I feel like, okay, I'm just gonna move on, whatever. It's there. I'm happy that a title explains what it is. Maybe somebody will find that useful.
I think it's because when you're making a video, you're thinking about how it's going to always be perceived in the future. So it can always stand alone. And I think the podcast almost is just an encapsulation of the moment that you're there. And it really is that, because you were saying, it's like, oh, when it flatlined, now I want to change the thumb. Now I want to change what I actually made, because all of a sudden it's not. And that isn't like the audience isn't enjoying it. That's the algorithm comment, right? And it's like, oh, it's the algorithm's not allowing it to whatever. So if I do this, that will allow it to. And just even going through that thought process now has clouded what you're going to do next time. Mm-hmm. And just how you approach it. Because now you're going to be like, oh, yeah, I did that thing, but then it didn't work. And now it did. And I mean, this whole podcast has come out of us being so wrapped up And we've met so many YouTubers who agree with the same thing, that you just get so wrapped up in this weird world of expectations.
Yeah, and what other form of art would you consider like retitling it if it was, you know, like you write a book and then after, you know, a few months it's not doing really, I better change the title of the book. That's what it needs. Or a movie. Oh, granted, there were some exploitation films in the 70s and 80s that would change titles on where they were.
Fair enough. And you can make a cut which takes out swear words to make it fair. I get that kind of stuff. But when you're literally trying your best to change
You've made a piece of art, and this is what I've made.
And like you said, now it's the video, Steve, is 13 days old. It has 121,000 views in all measures by any metric whatsoever. It is a 100% a successful video. Yeah. Had thousands of likes, hundreds of comments.
More people than were watching Elvis Costello last night.
Absolutely. Let's take that, Elvis Costello. And that's it. That's what we've been talking about. All of that burnout comes from like this exhaustion about things you've already created. And I remember when John was on the show and we were talking about John Peters was on the show and we were talking about art. And I was at the end of that podcast. I'm like, that's why I want to become an artist. Cause it's the one, like once I make a painting, you buy that painting exactly how it is. You don't come and be like, can you change this to blue? And that's what I love about painting. And I also realize that that's like the last thing that you get in YouTube is that world of just like change the packaging as much as you can.
What your channel is, if you're making a video and you're producing this material, it's art. To some extent you are making an artistic endeavor on that. And I guess I'm questioning, why do we have to, after your art is complete, go back and fuck with it? Why do we have this need of like, well, now I've got to have more eyeballs seeing my art. I have to see these numbers go up. And so the way to do that is I'm going to have to change the perception of what's going to get people to watch that video. I'm going to have to change that thumbnail to make it something that is more enticing and change the title. And I mean, I see it from both sides. I see it. Yeah, it's a business. You gotta earn a living on it. But you are making art.
But yeah, and isn't the business argument just like one of those things where it's like, yeah, of course, if you say it that way, it's gonna look that way. But like, life isn't that easy. And I would say that we talked about like in the past, personal brands, like when people moved from like realizing that you could have your own personal brand and like what that means and just be and have that. I think that kind of confuses the matter because then people see their little individual pieces of art as like a reflection of the larger brand. And like then again, you're going back into that mindset of like overthinking everything you're doing as opposed to just concentrating on actually just making a video like we used to do back in 2011 when it wasn't about partner programs and it was about like, hey, we're just sharing a video. Or is that just like old man waving his fist at the clouds?
Joel Haver recently, just this last week, had a video on his second channel about movies and how movie critics are doing it wrong, he thinks. And I really hadn't thought about this before, but his point is that if you're reviewing a movie and what these people are doing is that they're going through a checklist of things. So they're rating a subjective piece of art using an objective scale. So it's like, oh, was the lighting good? What was the camera work like? Was it well written? How was the dialogue? So you're just going through these things, and these are what comprise most reviews of movies, is people going through these checklists. And his contention is, if you're going to review a movie and talk about it, even just with somebody, you know, your friend that you saw it with, you don't really shouldn't talk about it that way. You should talk about the way that art made you feel. And it's like, I saw this movie and holy crap, I can't believe the range of emotions I went through from watching this and how it got me to think about the world differently. Or these characters were very important and I didn't want it to end because I wanted to see what was going to happen more. This kind of subjective review is more valuable than this objectivity we're placing on art.
That's really, really interesting, because I remember when I was whatever the coming of age was, of being afraid of horror movies, like afraid. As a kid, you're like, whoa, definitely don't want to. And then you watch one and you have whatever kind of experience you have with that and nightmares, da da da. And I remember rather early kind of getting past that, because my older brothers kind of said, like, part of the fun of this is the fact that it makes you feel uncomfortable, yeah. Right? It's like being on a roller coaster. It's like a roller coaster isn't fun as so much as it's like, I can't believe I'm
you're experiencing
doing
it.
This to myself. I can't believe I'm experiencing this. And that just kind of changed the way that I looked at these types of movies, because it became less about me just seeing something to gross me out or whatever, and me exploring, oh, that really hit me in a certain way to make me feel a certain way. Mm-hmm. And
I think that is why a lot of people don't like horror movies, is not because of the way it makes them feel. It's because they're looking at it from this objective standpoint of like, well, this is a low budget. This was poorly made. The guy didn't have enough skills to impress me, where, you know, he didn't have the $200 million Avatar budget or whatever. So therefore, it's not a valid piece of art.
And I'm most moved by things that either make me cry or scare me, because making me laugh is kind of like one thing, but like experiencing other emotions through art is really awesome, actually. That's kind of what...
That's the human experience, and all of these emotions are valid, and I think people will maybe not like a movie because it... And, you know, Hollywood doesn't like unhappy, sad endings. But if it's an honest ending, this is why I like indie films, because they can tell a story and have it end probably the way it should end. And there's nothing wrong with feeling uncomfortable. There's nothing wrong with even feeling like cringe. These are all part of the human emotional experience. And you shouldn't bar all of these from your personal experience and thinking, well, I only want happiness. I only want to be just fully entertained. I don't want to really have to think. I really don't like it when people say, I just want to shut my mind off when I watch a movie. It's like, well, that's fine, but there's nothing wrong with going to see a movie that's actually going to get you to think or feel a certain way.
You don't necessarily have to check your like common sense at the door when you're going to the latest Marvel, superhero movie, because it's like, it's so far-fetched and da da da. So wonderful that a simple story about something that you wouldn't normally, you know, kind of like give the time of day, but that makes you feel, you know, so much more connected because it's done in a less grandiose way, or there's less production value. Oh my gosh, Steve, imagine that. Movies created about character development and story and all of that.
And this is what's exciting about YouTube, is because these people, anybody can make a movie and put it on YouTube. And if you're willing to overlook the fact that they don't have a huge budget and enjoy the movie for what they're trying to do, you may not like it. You may, but the reason you're liking it is probably because it just didn't resonate with you on a personal or emotional level. You don't need to analyze it any further than that. You don't need to say, well, it was because the lighting was poor in some scene. And just because it didn't click with you, there will be people who it totally clicks with. I'm always amazed that there's movies that I absolutely hate, but there are people who think this is the best film ever made. This is a human experience.
It's like when you do it with such a simple, like without all of the effects and without all of the like safe stuff that you have, and it's just reliance upon a story and whatnot. And that's what I find kind of odd about YouTube, is people will find that success in a space, and then it's about replicating that as many times as possible, as opposed to extracting who kind of sees not the deeper meaning, but like whatever, the true fans or the true followers that will come along and want to see your other stuff, as opposed to the people that are like, I love when you do this. Can you just keep doing that? I miss the old Steve. Mm-hmm. Can you just keep being the old Steve?
Yeah. And place the value judgment for YouTube Like in movies, people place the value of a movie based on how well it did at the box office. That seems to be the, right. And if YouTube is no different, it's how many views did that video get? How many followers does a creator have?
Yeah. And then to measure each of the, it's the only place where each of the art pieces is measured in that direct, you know, no one looks at a painter who his last three paintings and like, oh, he sold this one for X amount, this month for this yeah. month. But like, for some reason, this all gets carried through with you. All of this gets carried through on this silly yep. YouTube
the commoditization
platform.
Of art. And here we are, part of it.
Do you know I used Shorts exclusively for the past 2 days? I've been doing a bunch of propagation of plants and getting some free plants. I love it. Free plants, I'm all down for. And I consider myself a pretty advanced YouTube user, and I usually would go for the epic gardening or 6 to 8 minute long videos where it's like, okay, this person looks like... I just did it through Shorts. Hmm. And surprisingly, there's enough people putting together some really good how-to shorts now, understanding that people are literally just searching for how to propagate peace lily. Very particular, you know, kind of a siloed search, but at the same time, a whole bunch of people would probably be searching for that. And back in the day, there'd probably be whatever, 150 videos, anywhere from 3 minutes to 8 minutes long. There'd be those few channels that have like 28 minutes, the complete guide to everything you want to know about. And now there are just like, hey, you literally are standing in the garden right now and in 30 seconds want to know, cut here, do this, go bloop, that, and you're done. And I started relying upon Shorts over traditional how-to videos. So I just wanted to share that story because I got some firsthand experience about how handy Shorts was. I saved myself a bunch of time.
Yeah, yeah. That's
and
cool.
I didn't have.
Have you determined, are YouTube Shorts searchable, or do they show up in YouTube search results?
Yes.
They do.
I was giving the benefit of the doubt to any video that I would see that was a good length and would have probably, like, do you know what I mean? Like when you can kind of just judge, like, this is a good video. It's 8 years old. Mm-hmm. This person's probably going to deliver it over the course of a whatever. But I realized that was like, it was a very particular style of video from 8 to 10 years ago that was being made. And then recently there's like all this different types of stuff. And then a lot of people started doing like 5 tips to do a thing and it became clickbaity. And when it became clickbaity, it started getting away from being able to practically search for how to propagate a peace lily. Because then it was like, okay, in this video, one of the tips was how to propagate a flower. It was kind of like a piece of, versus just putting out one piece of content, which is, you know, like this is what it was. We had that back in 2011, 2012, 2013, because people were on the platform doing it. And now it kind of seems like the new space that is being developed in right now is the short space, because it is so much handier.
Yeah.
And I realized how angry I was, not angry, how annoying it was to go to even a 4 minute typical old YouTube video. Hey guys, how you doing? My name's Julia and I'm in my garden. And today I'm going to show you how to propagate the peace lily.
Yeah.
For some reason, all of that, which I've known for years and years and years, because we've done it, just grated on my brain like a piece of cheese. It was, and I was like, I need to find Shorts. I need to find someone who has literally just cut the three parts of this video together in a really good short, and I can do it. And I was pleasantly surprised that I managed to propagate about 10 different plants all through the use of Shorts.
Wow, that's fantastic. I think that it's just an example of, you have to fit the format to what you're trying to accomplish, or find the right format for it. And you're right, you don't need that 4 or 5 minute video for a couple of, and you know what, they're doing like 5 tips to do, you know, like number three is going to be like, first buy a Squarespace website. You know, that'll be number three.
You realize all the excess, you realize all the people that were like, jump, the video starts at, you know, 1:29, and that used to be like, no, we have to do all the calls to action. For how are people going to subscribe if we don't tell them to subscribe?
People watching YouTube are like, wait a second, what's this? You could subscribe to channels?
Subscribe? And it's true. And there you go, self-aware in the content, just getting mixed in there with the content versus this 1 hour and 1 minute of conversation, which was not scripted, not prepared. Yeah. Obviously, anybody listening to this knows that it's scripted and unprepared. But that indeed is the difference.
Yeah, next week, Chad, we're going to be at VidCon.
That's exciting. So we're not going to record on Wednesday because it's flying day for me. But we're going to record an episode of this podcast.
Yeah, and we'll have to figure out a space to do California. It. I think we ought to just go up to that industry area up there on one of those outside couches and just set up shop.
We could just grab our phones and we could do like an on the street thing. It's like, hey, how are you? No, probably not. Let's
get Mr. Beast.
Do you think? Will he be there?
We can ask him about thumbnail design.
I went to the website to see all of the featured creators, and I don't know many.
I hadn't even looked at that yet. No, I'm pretty much out of the scene of these young.
Well, buckle up, Steve. In one week, we are going to be knee deep in youngsters. Well, that didn't sound right at all.
I better rephrase that. Well, Chad, it's been a great 100 episodes. I'm looking forward to the next 100.
Me too, Steve. Thanks for listening, everyone.